gaggle of geese. More fun than a room full of wombats. Able to reach huge audiences with a single broadcast. Yes, it's the Outdoor Journal Radio Show. And now, another exciting episode in the adventures of Outdoor Journal Radio.
Well, hello there. Hello there.
You didn't do it.
Nope.
You didn't do it, kid.
Hello there.
I like it. I like it.
Welcome to the program.
You're Outdoor insulted, Journal aren't you?
Radio. No, not at all. Welcome to Brian Mangevoil. He is Peter Bowman. The rest of the crew, you know them.
Bowman. Come on now.
Bobo over there. Dean over there. Nick sometimes
Nick
over
not
there.
Over there.
No, sometimes he shows up.
Nick never over there.
Whatever he likes. That's the beauty of it. It's a free, for Nick, it's a free society, right?
Yes, he certainly is. There's no doubt about it. And he knows it.
And he knows it.
Takes advantage of it very well.
As would I.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the show. Great show today. Joining us a little later on is an old friend of mine who used to be a regular on the Outdoor Journal radio show when it was with The Fan. And he was our in-house tech. His area of expertise is in the marine industry, although snowmobile industry, any a 4x4, like ATVs, all that stuff. He's an expert. His name is Stephen Tate.
Give me a hell yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, hell yeah, for sure. I can't wait to hear this stuff.
At the time, he was with Gordon Bay Marina, which is a huge marina in the Muskoka area. Mm-hmm. And he was their head honcho in terms of, I believe, the technical side.
Oh, yeah.
Of the company. Okay. Service.
So he knows his stuff.
He knows his stuff. And he was great. The audience loved him. And then we kind of fell apart when the radio show went off air. And I haven't had any connection with Steve forever. And then Pete and I were out. What were we doing?
We were at Lake Muskoka and Tony's boat broke down.
That's it. And we were in a boat that broke down, and that's how this whole thing started, because we needed to get some service done, and we ran into somebody who ran into somebody, and then next thing you know, Steve Tate's name came up in the mix, and I said, oh my God, I haven't talked to him in years. I talked to him, and he'll be joining us a little bit later on. So that's how that whole thing evolved.
Excellent.
But in the meantime, we have a wonderful show to present to you. Before we do that, I want to talk to everybody about maybe some of the wonderful looking.
Look at you, eh?
Eh?
You ever notice how he's got something brand new on every day, and I got the same old shirt
brand
on every day?
Spank. That's because I'm not afraid to spend a buck or two. But you have you have an emotional connection with each one of those.
Well, if you wouldn't overcharge bills. Me, you guys get one price. The company here gets one price. Then Pete gets the inflated.
The only thing you're inflating is those dolls that are sitting up on that thing. Those are kind of cool.
They're very, very interesting. Yeah. I can't wait to see somebody put a garment on top of one.
We're going to do that very shortly, and our friend Vova here is going to be the DOP on that one.
Ooh,
dope.
DOP.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
In the news on fishingcanada.com.
People have no idea what the hell we're talking about.
I don't know. That's good. Keeps them on their toes.
Okay, good.
Listener feedback. Episode 90. New strain of largemouth.
Yes,
we ran a story on fishingcanada.com about this Florida strain largemouth that are about to get even bigger. There's a new strain that's coming in. They call it Titan Max.
Great name.
A wonderful story. Max. Yeah, that's a great story. And it's all happening on episode 90. We talked about it if you're interested in going back and checking it out. But anyways, we had some feedback on it. Dan Robinson via Instagram says, howdy. That's what Pete was referring to.
That's right.
Now that big Supreme Bass thing, he says, that bothers me. We have open season on them up in Northern Ontario. And so if these
guys. On them, I'm assuming he means largemouth and smallmouth, like the bass that they're existing right now, right?
Yeah. And if these guys start to get into our waters, I can just picture the consumption of bait fish. Some things are better left alone. So I think what Dan is saying is that he's afraid that these Titan bass, he's not in agreement that we should be creating these monster species, whether it's bass or any other species, because you know, let's be honest about it. Nature had not intended mm-hmm. for them to be such, right?
Right.
So he's saying if they ever got into our Northern Ontario waters, they would wreak havoc on the forage.
I mean, he could be right. He could be right.
Why?
I don't know. Oh. I'm just saying, I mean, if it's a super fish, it may be, it is a feeding machine. The problem with that, I don't even know how they would, if there's a portion of Florida bass in there, like the F1 is half Florida, but half Northern strain,
right.
Largemouth bass. I don't know how well that would do way up north, because Florida strains apparently I don't think they could even live in, let's say, Lake of the Woods, the water.
But hence why the Northern strain gene would change that. I'm assuming that's what's going to happen.
Maybe the combination would help them live,
in colder water conditions. That's the whole idea behind it.
I don't know what the Titan Max, I can't remember what the, Dean, do you remember what the ratio was or what the the Florida bass versus whatever. But anyways, I mean, he's right though in that sense. Like, aside from natural, like a splake is a man-made, isn't it? Right. They can't do that naturally, right?
No.
A tiger muskie can be done naturally. Mm-hmm. Muskie and a pike get together, and I don't know if they wreak havoc any more than a muskie or a pike. I doubt very much there'd be any difference. Is a splake bad for the baitfish population?
The government has been using splake as the base for most of their stocking programs.
Right.
It seems
to be working well.
Well,
right? Doesn't it?
Yeah.
They taste good.
They taste good.
They look better than a straight lager.
Now, have they displaced other species? Well, I think the program that MNR started years ago, MNRF, with the splake, is that they would put them in environments where the natural fish populations had depleted. Mm-hmm. And so rather than stock more of this natural, because there's a reason why the natural strain had been depleted.
Right.
So they're saying, well, you know what? Rather than spend money on... Isn't it funny as I'm saying this?
Here we go. I know where we're going.
But isn't it... Like, talk about hypocrisy. It's coming out of my own mouth, and I'm listening to it, and it's so hypocritical. So MNRF decided that they needed to invent this fish called a splake to put in bodies of water where the native species, in most cases, speckled trout maybe, lake trout maybe, had depleted due to natural causes or maybe over-harvesting, I don't know. But rather than replenish the cupboards with the same inventory, they decided, let's create a new critter to put it in their place, and it's called a splake. And it was a wonderful program. It worked well. I enjoyed the benefits of that stocking program for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So are you 100% sure, though, that's why they did it? Because the one or the other or both died off? Is that the exact reason? For sure?
Oh, hell yeah.
Okay.
Hell yeah. Or lakes. The other reason that I'd heard that they put them in there is because somehow, and most of this happened in Algonquin Park. That was kind of the basis for this.
I saw that smirk on your face. You better watch your hands, fella, right now. Okay, sorry.
We'll tell you if we need to as to why I'm laughing. Just sit tight. Sit tight. This is about to get interesting.
Vova for prime minister. That's all I can say.
So anyways, in some cases, the problem was that there was an invasive species introduced to that body of water, whether it was perch. Usually perch was the culprit. Bluegill. A lot of panfish were being blamed. And so rather than put more good, what they consider to be good fish, which would be the speckled trout or the lake trout, they said, let's create a test tube fish. We'll call it the splake. We'll take all the best of lakers and all the best of specks, and we'll put them together, and we'll put them in that environment instead of wasting good quality inventory of natural fish. And it was a wonderful program. And as far as I know, they're still doing it. And it's enjoyed by anglers galore. It's just one. And then at some point, somebody said, hey, we need to replenish the natural Atlantic salmon on Lake Ontario.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
Thank you. And so let's now start spending millions of dollars, maybe turned into billions by now, who knows, millions of dollars on trying to reestablish the Atlantic salmon on Lake Ontario. So never mind the splake that we already spent money and are using elsewhere. Let's now, in this case, bring back the Atlantic salmon. Does that make sense to anybody?
So here's something I've just heard recently, by the way. We'll move on to Atlantic salmon very quickly. I've heard recently that there are a lot more catches than we are aware of.
Oh.
So, and the reason, and I said, go ahead, Dean.
There's a bunch of bullshit.
I said, okay, that's my, and maybe Mr. Bowman, you don't know the entire story. I says, okay, enlighten me on this. Atlantic salmon, as in a lot of fish in Ontario, have certain size limits. There's a size limit you have to have on Lake Ontario before you can keep it or whatever, something like that, right?
Possibly. I don't know. I can't verify that.
So they're saying that they're not, these people are not, the charter guys, the fishermen are not showing the fish because they don't really want to spread the word because they like the fishing and they're getting more than we think. Plus, they're not showing them because it's illegal to take the picture of these fish. So they don't want to do it. You know what I mean?
Like the, who in the whole hell
I was
trying to
that.
Perpetuate that bullshit.
They're not trying to perpetuate anything. They just told me that. And I just started that out here. That's what they're saying, that they don't want to show these because they're illegal to show on camera.
Yeah, let's go with that. Let's go with
that. There you go.
Let's go with that and move on because I'll get ugly here. That's a great one. That's a great
one. What about the lakes with acid rain? Did they do that with the splake?
I think the splake was thrown everywhere. It was a mule, right? Okay. It is a hardy fish. It serves well as food.
Apparently it eats great.
Really great. Eats great.
Well, you've eaten them, Dean, haven't you?
I've eaten them. Yeah, yeah.
I've lived on them for 18 years in Algonquin.
So is it comparable to a brook trout?
I think it's better.
Really?
Quite honestly,
lake trout's not as good as brook.
It's way better than lake trout.
Yeah, way better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And to me, it's better than brook as well.
Really?
Maybe it's psychological because I hate the thought of killing a brook trout to consume it.
Right.
Maybe that's happening, but...
I don't know, man. You get in a creek and you get that little guy about 12 inches long on a creek, I have no problem putting a fillet knife into that sucker.
Dare say that you could put a splake in its place and you wouldn't even know.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah,
no,
I believe that. I've heard they're really good. Anyways, go back very quickly to Dan. Everybody's got their opinion, and he's probably right. They might rehab it. We don't know yet. They're a brand new species, right?
Anytime you introduce something new into an environment, it has... potentially,
especially with a name like Titan Max,
like that scares me.
I am Titan Max. I will eat you, perch.
But in order for that to happen, there'd have to be a lot of things going on. First of all, now if it happens illegally, as in some idiot, some moron decides that he needs to play God and introduce him, then that's a different ballgame altogether. In which case.
Then it could be trouble.
Then it could be trouble for sure. But it's an interesting conundrum. You know, it's funny. We love the idea of big fish, especially bass, like the bigger the better. But we don't ever think of the consequences that would maybe take place if that.
But you know what? If you asked me deep down inside, said, Pete, we're going to have northern strain largemouth that have been natural in Ontario or Canada forever. You got a Titan Max and we got the F1s. We're going to introduce it all. I'd still rather get the Canadian record northern strain natural than I would any of the others. If I was going to get a record fish, I'd rather
Wait a minute.
Let's just say the Titan Max got 4 pounds bigger, or the F1s got 4 pounds bigger, and the Titan Max got 6 pounds bigger. It'd be great to get a 16-pound Titan Max largemouth in Canada, but I think I'd rather get the natural northern strain largemouth bass that we've always had. I'd rather have that record than anything else that came in here.
And what would that be?
What weight would that be? 10.41, I think, is the.
So you would rather catch a 10.41 natural largemouth bass.
10.6, because you have to be over. Remember?
10 and change. 10 and change.
Yes.
So you would rather catch a 10 and change. Let's say you're on Lake Muskoka, just for the sake of arguing.
And beautiful.
You're fishing there one day, and the leprechaun that we often talk about when you and I are on a boat comes down on the cliff, right, is up there, and say,
Pete, he's not going to do that.
Here.
Oh, he's going to do something different. Okay. I don't like the leprechaun you introduced the first time. Okay, go ahead.
So, come here.
Yeah.
And you use the trolling motor to go over because it's shallow where he is. He comes wandering down the cliff there and says, look it, if you do me a favor, I'm going to bestow upon you one wish. And you being who you are, you do him the favor, because I know you would, and you wish for a, you would wish for, or no, he gives you three wishes. Right. Sorry, he gives you three wishes.
That's
and wish number one is going to be a...
Northern strain largemouth bass.
No, hang on for a minute.
Okay.
Is going to be a world record F1.
Yep.
Okay. A world record Florida strain... whatever the new Titan Max. Or a world record Ontario largemouth.
Northern strain. Right? It wouldn't be a world record. It couldn't be a world record.
Oh,
I said a Canadian record.
Canadian record. So you've got those three choices. World record, Canadian record. You would pick the smaller of the three.
That would shock me, by the way. You know what?
I'd be shocked.
That was not what I was talking about, but
because
I was talking about
it,
I didn't know if they were in Canada. And it was a Canadian record. Each one of them was a Canadian record. I'd rather have the lowest of the Canadian records. I'd rather have the natural. But that said, I'd still take the Canadian record largemouth bass over an F1 record or a Max record, world record.
And you would do that for...
Pick me, Mr. Leprechaun, wherever you are.
You would do
Genie.
That for Mr. Leprechaun.
Whatever, yeah.
To get that. So. You would do what you had to do to get that.
Yeah, I like that. Just that thought of a 10 Canadian record.
I would do it.
I would do it.
I know you would. That's a strange part about this whole conversation.
No, what he's talking about is the strange part of this conversation. Okay, I'm just talking about record fish. I have no idea what's going through that shithead.
There's
over
a
there.
Price. There's a price for everything, my friend.
I'm just going to earn it the hard way by fishing. That's all I'm going
right,
to do. It.
All right. Anyways, no, I'm just
you
joking
sick
with
bastard.
All right. Hopefully, we've killed that subject, Dan Robertson.
There you go, Danny.
Podcast network highlights. We need to talk about that real quick.
Yes, you apparently you did a little guest appearance on the Eating Wild podcast.
I did too. And what boy, those guys are good.
Episodes 19 and 20. You got two.
Well, yeah, they kind of talked me into staying on a little longer than I had committed to. We had a good time. Had a great time. Learned a lot about sharp. My biggest weakness is sharpening knives. I've always felt that I didn't have the complete...
Most of us are like that.
Right? I get it sharp. I can sharpen it, but it's not that. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like you watch guys, they sharpen, and then they just drop a piece of paper on the blade, and
I can't
do that.
Yeah.
So the boys kind of taught me.
I bet. Do they use a steel? Do they use the steel?
That's I do. Yeah? I do, right?
I cheat. I bought an electric one. High-end electric one.
What do you mean?
And one of those ones you put, it's either the Western angle or the Japanese angle on it. And I choose the Western angle on it, and I run my knife. And then I take the polishing blade. And I polish it after that. I do it all with a switch.
Well, you lazy bastard.
I know. Because I know I can't do the right angle.
I would
and all
have never
that,
thought.
Like
somebody
that.
Asked me that, I'd just say, bullshit. Not Peter Bowman. Yeah. He would never take the shortcut.
I bought one because they're damn efficient. These things are, for those that don't know how to sharpen with the steel, it's a pretty good option.
But it's so much, what I learned from these guys
is that
I'm not an idiot.
Because
I
stuff,
love
right?
that tradition.
So you just called me an idiot, right? That's nice. That's really nice. You know, as we're sitting here, you want me to have some kind of weird shit with a leprechaun, and now you want to call me an idiot. Like, where the hell is this podcast going to, people?
No, I love the sound and the feel of that steel against steel.
I love it too. It's cool, but I just choose my easier way of doing it. Quick, because I'm doing a bunch of fish.
Well, you might want to tune in to episode 19 of Eating Wild because they will teach you.
Not 20?
No, it was in 19.
Okay.
They will teach you how to properly sharpen that knife. You'll throw away that electric piece of crap you bought.
Okay.
And you'll use the steel, because there's nothing like steel on steel for sharpening. As far as
metal on metal.
Yeah. Anvil. Anyways, we talked about all kinds of things. We talked about shore lunches, which was very cool.
Yes.
Told them that I actually had done my first turducken from scratch, and they found that absolutely fascinating. So we went through that. I had a great conversation with him. It's a wonderful.
How long
episode.
Did it take you to debone those birds? Remember?
But if for all three, about 40 minutes to an hour. The turkey was the biggest issue.
I talked to a friend, a mutual friend of ours, mm-hmm. whose brother-in-law is a professional chef, mm-hmm. and he can do a bird in a couple minutes. Is that possible? This is what he told me. That's what I said to him. I says, okay, Ange just told me about going through it for hours and upon hours and this and that. He says, no, this guy can do it. He's done thousands of birds, and he can just do it. It's deboned. Is that possible?
Before I answer that, I do have to tell the audience now why I'm smirking over in that direction every once in a while. You see, I have a bad habit.
Oh, that's why you're smirking. I thought you were laughing at me.
No, I like to run my hand to the edge of the table here. It's like a comforting thing. It's like a security blanket.
They can't see it right now, their hand.
And they can't see it because my hand's off screen.
Can they see your cup? Can they see his cup above right now?
Yeah, they can see
his cup.
Yeah.
Okay.
But every time I do this, my hand goes off screen. And our director, Vova, now has threatened me that when I do that, he's going to hit my hand.
You won't see it when you do that. You can't try it. But Vova, if he did it, if you move your hand in and Vova just gave a little tap just to show everybody what he's going to do.
He's going to hit me with a fishing rod. He's going to hit me with my own fishing pole. That's what he's going to do. He's going to hit me. People, listen to me. He's going to hit me with my own fishing pole because I'm reaching for comfort. This is a security thing for me. But he doesn't want me doing that anymore.
Maybe it's like your sister, Mary Rosalia there.
Sister Mary Rosalia.
They slapped you with
God,
the strap.
God, she was an awful woman.
You know what I mean? God, Vova's sister, Vova. He's going to slap you like Rosalia did there.
Anyways, this might get ugly before the end of the show, folks. I just wanted to make sure you understood. Now, to get to your point,
Vova, you have permission. If you need to pop him with the fishing stick, you go ahead, buddy. And if he doesn't like using his, I'll bring in a nice noodle rod for you.
If he did that, there'd be an outroar from this audience. I'll guarantee you.
They'd love it.
They got my back.
I'll guarantee you they got my back. If you got snapped with a fishing rod, they would go nuts for it.
They got my back. I know them well.
I know they do.
To get to your point, can you debone a bird?
Five minutes.
At this point, I'm not even going to, ask, what science of bird is it?
No.
It's irrelevant. You cannot. I would love to be there and watch that happen.
I'm asking.
He specifically said 5 minutes?
Yeah, something like that. It was a ridiculous number. I said, come on.
It will take longer than that to separate the ball joints of the wings
and
legs.
Oh, ball joints, sorry.
Ball joints. I call them ball joints, whatever they're called. Because that's one of the most time-consuming parts, because you can't rip the skin when you're doing that. So it's a very time-consuming element. And I don't think you could do that on all four of those joints in 5 minutes, regardless of the size of the bird. Now, obviously, when you're talking to turkey, I was going to call you to come and help me pull that apart. That's how bad that one was. So I don't know, Pete. I don't know who you're talking about, but whoever, if he's watching, you know what? If you could, I would love to see it.
We should ask Antonio. Maybe Antonio would know how fast.
Antonio was fascinated that I could even do it.
Right, but I wonder maybe he's got a record time that he said it'd be.
He says he's pretty quick.
Yeah,
because he does so many of them.
That's
now,
what this guy says. He's done thousands of them.
All right.
So I don't know.
You know what? It's okay. Anything's possible. How's that? Let's leave it at anything.
I didn't
possible.
Know what a turducken was until you told me. Yeah. I heard this turducken. I said, "What the hell is a turducken?"
What it makes a wonderful stupid name. If you name. Have never had one,
yeah.
My God, you have to try one because you get all of these wonderful tastes all together.
So like a coho, a walleye, and a muskie, it'd be a Kowalski. Thank you, Dean.
He is awake. Holy mackerel. Not much. But
you can't eat the muskie.
You know what? We got to get him off the couch.
I don't want to eat muskie.
We got to get him off the couch.
Walleye you can eat. Kowalskirch, a perch. We'll have to figure out a triple fish.
Triple fish. Well, walleye's got to be the bait. And pike. Pike would be the outside, right? And then a walleye, and then a perch.
You need a Chinook, like a spring, West Coast spring for a big fatty.
I don't think you want to mix salmonoids with freshwater, do you?
Yeah, I'd try that. I'd like to try it. Maybe.
Freshwater. So. All right.
And you get the oily fish and you get the flaky fish.
All right. If anybody's done that, by the way, let us know. We'll work on it ourselves and let you know.
Anyways,
I don't know where we were going with that, but wherever it is, we got completely.
Gotta be a good podcast, that's for sure.
Derailed.
I can't wait to listen to it. I haven't heard it yet, but I will.
New on fishingcanada.com. North America's most overlooked species is also the oldest. Now,
interesting.
The story is all about carp. Obviously, that's we're calling that North America's most overlooked species, but
carp.
Yeah.
Okay. Isn't it?
The whole, or do you think they're speaking specifically of the big mouth buffalo?
I think there's yeah.
All right.
Number one, because a big mouth buffalo is not a carp.
It's not, but I wouldn't call it North America's most overlooked species. Would you?
No, I don't think so.
I think that's sensationalizing. That's clickbait.
But that's what the
that's clickbait right there.
See, people, you know, you have to go to the website to check it out. See that? Look at that sucker right there. That's a buffalo. That's a big mouth buffalo.
Yes, it is.
They're in the sucker family, believe it or not. And if you look, that looks just like a carp, but everybody that's caught a carp, they have little barbels. These guys don't have any barbels on there. Yeah. So you're thinking it's a carp, and it looks just like a carp. We thought that fish, remember?
Yeah.
We thought that was a carp.
Yeah.
And then,
well, we were
Paul
carp
Castellano.
Fishing.
Yeah.
We were carp fishing.
Paulie said, no, guys, that's a big mouth buffalo.
Anyways, a new study out of the University of Minnesota Duluth focuses on the oldest and longest living genus of freshwater fish, Ichthyobus genus.
Good man.
Ichthyobus genus.
I love it.
Known as the buffalo fish or big mouth buffalo. It can live up to 110 years. Now, I was surprised when I first read that. This whole story, to be honest with you, was kind of, to me, a little bit off kilter because forever I have assumed that the oldest living freshwater fish would be the white sturgeon.
Correct.
That's what I think is the oldest, longest living.
Until I looked into it.
You did the research for this?
No, I've read the article and then it's some research afterwards.
Because I was going to say, if I'm relying on your research for this, then I know it's a bunch of
bullshit. Listen to me now and talk to me later.
Okay.
So I had a few species in mind of the same thing you're saying. Sturgeon was one of them. Gar was another. And lake trout. We always hear about lake trout, how old they live. You know what I mean?
They can live over 100, I thought.
No. Here's what I got. So first off, the big mouth buffalo has been recorded up to 127 years old, not 110.
So we're reporting that.
It depends where you're getting your information, right?
Yours better.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Of the three that we're talking about, the long-nosed gar is the least. It can live up to 39 years old.
Oh, wow.
I thought it'd be a lot older than that. That thing has been around here for 100 million years, long-nosed gar.
Right.
But yet they still only grow to 39 years old.
Right.
Lake trout can live up to 60 years old. I thought they were older than that, but apparently they're only up to 60 years old, and that's an old one. Mm. And the sturgeon of all species of sturgeon, you put it in a generic...
the paddle?
Because there's like
is that the
19
paddle?
Different species or something like that.
Is the paddle is the oldest?
They didn't say the oldest, but they said 60 to 80 years. 80 years old is the oldest sturgeon that they can find recorded.
See, so you can only get this stuff on fishingcanada.com. I mean,
we're on our podcast, the Outdoor General Radio podcast, right? Podcast, see? Yeah. Absolutely. That's why they got to stick with us.
Wonderful research, my friend.
Thank you.
I think you're wasting your talents here.
You know what, with the talents and good looks and the whole package that I run on a daily basis, you're right. I do. I am wasting it all here.
apparently it was a breakthrough and it's going to hopefully help us.
One more thing about the big mouth buffalo?
Yes.
It's native to North America.
No.
Yeah.
Not in Europe.
Nope. It's our fish. You know who has got some giants? Is Texas. They have a whole sport fishery for these. I've seen it online years ago, and they got some giants.
Like, what are we talking?
I don't know weight-wise, but they're just massive. They're like those France common carp and stuff like that. They're so big. And it's a real, it's a business down there. And they do the same thing. They shore fish them just like carp fishing and that. But it's
so it's just up here in Canada that we really don't pursue them. U.S. sounds like they got their shit together.
For sure. They do pursue them. Yeah.
University of Duluth, Minnesota Duluth is kind of, because of this newfound information, calling for more protection of the species because obviously they're being fished
they're
a lot.
They're getting bow hunted too. They're doing the old kill them all sort of thing.
God, with all due respect to hunters, there's some areas where I have to disagree. And to me, I know some of you are going to write and say, oh my God, he's the anti-Christ of fishing. He's going to take down our whole fishery with these comments. No, I just don't see the sport in going over top of a fish and shooting a bow and killing it with an arrow. Like, I just don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not sport.
I get you.
Now,
if it was just one and you were going to eat it, maybe.
Well, or...
it's like a deer or it's like anything else. You know?
And or, if it's illegal to shoot that carp, because that's what's being targeted, obviously. It's the only thing that's legal with a bow. But if it's illegal or immoral, like ducks, for example, you can't shoot ducks on the water.
Well, you can, but you're.
But it's not. But it's
duck hunter's morality.
It's the moral compass thing, yeah, right? Why? Because come on, give the thing a fighting chance at least, and also challenge yourself to be able to move and shoot. Mm-hmm. That to me is very doable.
Yeah.
So why can't we do the same thing with carp? Like you know, if
they
can't
fly,
it's got to be moving. It's illegal. It can't fly. You're an idiot. Then you wonder why I call you an idiot. But maybe we should make it illegal to shoot a carp that's sitting there minding its own business. And you, Mr. Big Hunter, you know, can sneak up on top of it and shoot an arrow through it.
Yeah, it's always been bizarre. That happen in one time. I was up at an area and Hunter was with me.
Yeah.
We shot it. Remember, we shot it on, as part of the Fish and Canada Show.
Yeah.
And we saw the guys up there, and they were just stalking these things like Robin Hood out in the forest. You know what I mean? And they were throwing them, and they literally just threw them up on the bank, and they were flopping around. You know, and so these fish they got a hole in them, and they can't breathe, and all that. So it did look pretty barbaric, I have to say. And I don't know what they were using those carp, if I'm not mistaken,
to give
it to a farmer. No, they were giving it to farmers that they were going to process the meat and feed some kind of animals with it, is what they were saying. So that's what the but just seeing them laying there on the dirt, flopping around, arrow holes and all that stuff. Like,
and
blatant, these guys were blatantly doing it. Like, they weren't hiding, but just saying, okay, I better not let the public, this is a public area. Throw her up there, flop, 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 flop.
If anybody out there does this and you think what we're saying is offside, let us know. I'd be curious. I'd be curious in engaging in some form of conversation about it, to be honest with you. I just can't see it. I don't see the reason for it.
Yeah.
But anyways.
There's a lot of hatred towards carp to begin with, right?
Yeah.
There is that, too. Oh, there's things that shouldn't be here. They're invasive and that they're not good and blah, blah, blah. So
my hand out there again. I'm pulling. Oh. Hey, you know what, Vova? You know, dogs, like when a dog has an ear infection, they put that funnel around its head so it can't scratch.
Yeah, the cone of death.
Yeah, maybe we could develop a cone or something
cone
for me.
Of
maybe
shame.
I put a cone and have my hands like in here. Like
if you just put a cone on your hand, you
on
would never
head,
it would remind you. You'd do, oh God, I can't do that. Just keep that hand right there.
Oh my God. Anyways, great story. It's happening on fishingcanada.com as we speak in the news section. You might want to weigh in on it. Check it out, read it, and see what you
check it.
I know it's a long thing, and Dean's got took the time. Dean's got us reading all kinds of stuff on it. But, you know, if I read you the whole article, then you don't need to go to fishingcanada.com and check it out. So
come on now.
There's an adventure just outside these walls.
It's something you'll hate to leave and can't wait to get back to.
It's a place where memories are made and bonds are forged.
For some, it's hitting the trails. For others, it's a weekend at the lake. It's a place full of campfires and quality time.
This year, take some time to reconnect with friends, family, and nature. No matter what adventures await you, Coleman has the gear you need. Visit ColemanCanada.ca to gear up today.
The outside is calling.
Answer the call.
What do football, hockey players, boxers, and fishing guys have in common?
A love for the outdoors.
I'm Jamie Pastilli, a fishing guide with a lifetime of experience chasing down some of North America's most sought-after species with some of the world's most interesting characters. On Outdoor Journal Radio's Tackle Box podcast, I'm joined by one of those people, CFL legend Brad Sinopoli, as we share stories and talk to the athletes who found their passion through hunting and fishing.
World heavyweight champion Tyson Fury, they brought you in to spar this big animal.
I had a rod, so just randomly brought it to Colorado. It got me hooked up on some beautiful fish in those big rivers. And it was some of my best memories of during my hockey career.
So join Jamie and I every week on the Tackle Box for a behind-the-scenes look at some of your favorite athletes and angling personalities.
From hits to tangles, passes into angles, the Tackle Box has your sports and angling listening covered.
Find the Tackle Box now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.
Alrighty, fan question of the week. This is starting to become my favorite part
Show, eh? Absolutely love it.
Keep those questions coming in, folks. We enjoy them. Although this one's going to be a little different because we're going to now bring our guest on who is going to help us answer this question because it has to do with boats what better person
to bring on
Steve Tate, Vice President of Sales at Maple Leaf Marinas. How are you doing, buddy?
Great. How are you doing?
We're doing good, buddy.
It's been a while. For those of you who have followed the Outdoor Journal radio show for a while, you know that Steve was a semi-regular on that program. He was our marine and anything that runs tech, we used to call him in to answer questions. So awful nice of you to join us again. And more importantly, I just want to tell folks, Steve is in a new position now. I will just briefly mention, because I feel compelled to, because I just found out about this recently. You didn't tell me anything, buddy, by the way. Maple Leaf Marinas, what is it?
Yeah, thanks. So Maple Leaf Marinas is the largest operator of marinas, marine resorts, and marine dealerships in Canada now. So we have 19 marinas, and they're all centrally located in basically cottage country in central Ontario. We provide a wide range of services for boats, basically, anywhere from, like, call it 6 to 8 feet all the way up to 100 feet. So it's a pretty wide product offering, and it's a great company to be with and learn even, I'd been doing this stuff for quite a while, and I'm learning a lot more every day now as well. So it's very exciting.
Wow. I was shocked. I told people when we first heard about it, I was shocked.
Yeah.
You've always been the Gordon Bay guy. So anyways.
Well, Gordon Bay is part of that.
Yeah.
It's part of the group, right?
Yeah. So. Part of the family. Yep.
By the way, if you think we're going to let you get away with that backdrop without saying a word, wow. I think not.
When is this the airing, Dean? Is this like a November airing of this podcast-ish? Any idea?
This is last week in November.
Okay. Last week in November.
So it could be.
But I think that the trees and he's not in Muskoka, I don't think, or anything like that. I can tell the mountains.
Actually, that looks pretty damn good. I'm telling you right now.
It does look good, doesn't it? I like it.
We always believe, a nice boat goes along with a nice cottage. So
True enough.
Steve, we're bringing you in a little bit early because this week's fan question, as we just alluded to, is about boats and marine, and you could probably help us answer the question. It comes to us from Nicholas Tryon from Napanee,
the place to be.
You're probably related to him or something.
No, just old fishing buddies or something, right. Hunting buddies.
Napanee, Ontario. He sends it via email, and he says, what's he saying here? He fished with
Jamie Pastilli on the Ottawa River. His wife went out. I think they went on two outings, and they did well.
Wow.
They got muskies on both trips,
muskies.
I believe. Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he says, howdy. I wanted to start by thanking you for the content.
Did you notice how he said howdy?
Howdy. He's listening.
I found out who that was. That's Minnie Pearl.
Minnie Pearl.
Remember I said, who is that? Or who is that?
That's it.
Minnie Pearl. There you go, buddy.
So he says, howdy. I wanted to start by thanking you for the content that the ODJ Podcast Network and the Fishing Canada show provides. 10 out of 10.
Yes.
Hello. Thanks, Nick. I met Pete at the Flying J. Do you remember this?
Flying J in Napa? Not really, because I met a lot of people on my day.
In Napanee about 15 years ago.
15 years ago. Do you think I'd remember that, Ed, no. Knowing me?
No.
15 days ago? No.
He gave me a signed fishing card.
Remember those old cards
we had? Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool. I found some of my desk, by the way. I'm going to do something with them.
My cards? Some of me?
Yours, mine, them? And Reno's. Oh,
no way.
So I think what we're going to do is have a contest somehow for those three cards.
Cool.
Yeah. He says, I still have them in a box today. My question is, here we go, Steve. Now pay attention, buddy. Just like the old days here. Okay, all right. I'm curious about tips for late season boat care. Is there anything extra to do versus summer fishing, such as adding a fuel additive, et cetera? I'm really curious about how you store your boat after a day on the water. After a day on the water. Whoa. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't have heated storage. I would love to do some late season fishing, but I'm terrified of having water in the engine and having it freeze overnight. Great question, because I don't think there's very many people that know the definitive answer to being able to run a boat, put it inside or in storage, run it the next day, run it back during the fall season.
Or leave it outside in your driveway. Leave it outside. That's what most people are doing, yeah. Right?
So, Steve?
And this time of year, by the way, just to add to that, you can have days of, like today, plus 10, you know, beautiful day of fishing. You throw it in the driveway and then it goes down to -3 to -5 tonight. And then tomorrow's back plus 10. You don't really know, but that's, you know, whatever, if there's water in there, it could freeze. So...
Let us know about that. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really fantastic question, because it actually, you know, appeals to pretty much all the range of boaters, in the sense that you could have, you know, a boat in a boathouse on a lift. You could have a boat just at a dock. You could have a boat in a driveway. And actually, the answers vary between all of them. But the fundamental thing to understand, I mean, and I guess I should start with asking, I'm assuming it's an outboard, because if it's an inboard or an inboard outboard, the conversation is going to be much more in depth.
I would think it's an outboard.
Let's
for
look
sure.
at it as an outboard for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, so if it's an outboard, I mean, I think the thing to understand is that, you know, at this time of year, if the boat's in the water is warmer than the air in theory, and the boat actually has a little bit more of a chance from freezing. So if you're hovering right around it, you're actually best to leave it in the water. Nights like last night, for example, in Cottage Country would have frozen probably a block on the ground, but the water's still, you know, open. You can still boat. It would probably be fine sitting in the water.
Okay,
interesting.
Yeah, the big thing is most houseboards are self-draining. So, I mean, even if you just give it a bark, it's usually okay. The thing I look towards now, and I mean, he raised great questions, was the systems on the boat are not as durable or designed to drain on their own like the outboard motor is. So the concern many years ago before all these systems existed in boats was, hey, the outboard motor is not as advanced. It doesn't drain as easily as you think. And you got to make a point to do something with that outboard motor. Now the outboard motor is very advanced. You know, it is pretty self-draining to a degree. And the boat systems have gone much more extravagant. And as a result, they now need the care. So my recommendation would be just making sure that all your pumps are drained, that you don't have any water in a live well, you know, anywhere. I mean, at the end of the day, most of the boats are light gauge aluminum. You know, they're aluminum, it flexes. When things freeze in there, it could push even a seal, some silicone, a rivet out, anything that hold one of these tanks together. And that really is probably going to be, you know, the really infuriating problem, because it's not something you're going to notice right away either. It's just going to annoy you that you're like, why do I have water? Why do I have this here now when I shouldn't? So my recommendation is really knowing your individualized boat, watching those pump systems. The other thing is, you know, even electronics, everything's loaded nowadays. It can't hurt just to make sure, give it a wipe off, make sure there's no excess moisture before you're putting covers on, and that doesn't, you know, freeze then unfreeze and cause, you know, glaring screen issues and things like that. So I would watch more of the systems on the boat. Not saying the motor isn't in need of care, but yeah. And I would also always make a point of, you know, ironically, boating is a warm weather thing, you hope, right? And warm weather is actually harder on fuel than cold weather. So as we're going into the colder seasons, in theory, the fuel isn't actually as big a concern, as long as it's not just sitting for months.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, fuel even sitting for a day baking in the sun, it's not great for it.
Interesting.
So we have two things here. First of all, one thing you said that really stood out with me. it at this time of year, it's almost better to leave it in the water.
Yeah, I've never heard of that either.
That's I haven't great. Either. That's great information.
Advice. Yeah.
So this time of year,
that's
as long
if you
as
you can, right? Obviously, most people can't if they're trailering too.
No, but at the cottage, for example,
right?
Rather than take it out every night.
Yeah, from the weekend on Sunday, you know, just leave it in the water. Water's not going to freeze, which this time of year doesn't
it's
freeze
not going
yet.
To.
That's
so
an interesting
that's
one.
That's good. And the other one is something we never think of, but then we have heated storage, so we don't need to. But even before, we never thought about it. And that is the boat itself. Live wells, pumps.
Oh, yeah. Well, my boat's in my driveway right now, and I do it every year. And I fish right until December, right. As a rule, open water. And Steve's right. Your live wells, you got to make sure. I had a pike in it the other day. I forgot about the pike, and then I got home and I said, "Oh, damn! I got a pike in there. I had to go back out and get it with water in there. You know, the pike was dead, but it was still in water. I wanted to keep it. So you got to remember that kind of stuff and let it drain off. A tip that I do all the time. Steve, and you'll probably agree with this, is that when I put the boat on the trailer after a day on the water, you're tying everything down. So like Steve says, you just give it one quick spurt, but you make sure you're trimmed it all the way down. So all the water is just draining yes. out of that bottom end like that. Just leave it there. And then that's the last thing you do is then you trim it up, put your motor tote on there, or whatever, your transom saver on there, trailer at home. And then on your driveway, it's not even a bad idea to just take that motor tote off and put it right back down again, leave it in your driveway to drain any excess water that way. It's kind of an easy tip to do.
It sounds mindless, right? When mm-hmm. you think about it, you say, well, yeah, of course you do that, but most yeah, of us don't.
Most of us you don't. Know? But right, when you're just strapping everything down, yeah. just leave it all the way down, and then that just gets enough water out of it that there's no problem. Another thing that I'm sure Steve will agree with, this doesn't cost you a whole lot, and it's easy to do at home if you want, is about September-ish. If you're going to do what I do is push it right through the limit, is change your gear oil. Mm-hmm. In the fall, so that there's no water in there that can freeze. Even if you do it again in the spring, twice doesn't hurt. It's not a real expensive. Changing your seals is going to be expensive. Everything else, if you have a problem, is going to be. Just get that gear oil changed in the early fall, so that if there's any water in there, it's gone. Then you got pure gear oil in there, and that'll last you right through the winter and then into the spring. So that's what I do, anyways.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, gear oil, we don't even look at it as a recommendation. It's a need. You need right. to check it to make sure there's no water in there. Again, the aluminum housing on most of the lower ends now is much more, you know, designed for efficiency than it is to be fracked by
right.
improper maintenance, to be truthful, right? Yeah. So you just, 100% agree with that. The other thing I would say, too, is your pumps. You know, you brought up a good point there is, the manufacturers have done a great job of making a product in a wide range for almost everybody, right? So you have pumps that are very, you know, plasticky and value oriented, and then you'll have very heavy, heavy duty brass pumps that are a lot more robust. You know, the tolerance levels between those is different for what they can handle, right? So I think it's very key to watch your boat components. Mm-hmm.
Something you said, I just want to clarify about change. You said, or you can change it in the spring again. That's if you use the boat after you change it in the fall. You obviously would not change it in the fall, put the boat away, and then
right.
change it in the spring.
What I'm saying is if you change it, clear it in September, then use it September, October, November,
exactly.
the boat,
exactly.
then you, could,
yeah.
you should change it in the spring again, yeah. just to be safe. Yeah. It's not expensive.
Yeah, it's a little overkill,
yeah,
my opinion, but obviously it's good for him. We had an opportunity to use one of your marinas this year.
That's right.
We had a problem
Lake Muskoka.
On Lake Muskoka. We had a problem, and that was one of the recommendations that was made by Chris, I think the gentleman's name was, the mechanic.
Spirit Bay, is that the marina?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a great place. Those guys
said,
were fantastic.
And he said to me, what was the last time we changed the gear oil?
Or you did the Lake of Bays there. That one you're talking about?
Where we changed the lower
Baysville.
Unit.
Baysville. That Baysville, was Baysville. Yeah. We went to two of them, Baysville and Spirit Bay. Yeah, okay.
He says, when was the last time?
Again, coincidentally, the general manager is the same person at both, and he's a big fan of your show. He's been listening for a long, long time.
Oh, right, great. On. Fantastic. Right, but anyways, the mechanic said, when was the last time you changed the lower unit oil? I looked at him. He looked at me. I mean, well, you know,
last November,
maybe. And he looked at me. You got to be kidding me. I said, no, he said, well, we're changing. We're changing it right now. And he did. And he pulled out. It's a good thing because it was in need. And we just forgot about it last year. We were in such a hurry to put things away for the season that the boat. Now it is dry storage. You know, it's.
That's the problem, is that it's in dry storage. We think everything is honky-dory. It's all beautiful. It's all nice. It's because it's in dry storage. It doesn't make any difference. You need to change your fluids, right?
And it was black, man. It needed changing, let me tell you.
Well, and to that point, like I would, you know, I kind of split the difference with you guys. You know, you probably don't need a new oil twice, but you should be checking it twice. So in other words, it is recommend you do it in the fall. You know, if you get a little bit of milk that comes out, you put brand new stuff in. You want to check again in the spring to see if milk has even, you know, occurred just from sitting from rainwater, anything, because then, you know, you got a real problem and you're dealing with the problem before you're out on the water and kind of stranded.
Yeah, that's a great point.
I almost got stranded because I forgot to put the phone off.
Oh,
so I just did.
Something else very quickly, maybe for Nick to he asked about fuel additives. Just run premium fuel, the best fuel you can, no matter what. Every day in your outboard motor, it is highly recommended, and I know Steve will say the same thing, run premium fuel. Do not run that garbage low-octane stuff. That's it's a key. So,
well, tell us about that. First of all, let's end that question so we can get into some of the other stuff. I hope we've answered the question
for Nick,
and keep them coming in. The more often you write those for us to read on air, the more often Steve will be in to answer them. How's that?
There you go.
So keep them coming. Simply go to fishingcanada.com and or info@fishingcanada.com would be the quickest way, but you can pretty much hook up with us through all of our social media arrays.
Yep.
Just ask the question. Dean will put them in his magic 45-gallon drum that he throws them all into and pull one out.
Dean,
before
Dean, that drum must be getting heavy by now. Shit, you got to put it up on your shoulder every week and get it like, churn around like
that's
that.
A bunch of bullshit.
That's right. Thank you. Anyways, we love answering them. So, and nothing's dumb. If it's a question, it's worth asking. Plain and simple. Because nothing is off the table when
it comes
to
dumb and dumber here. So it can't be worse than that.
We're good to go. All right. So, Steve, a couple of things quickly here. First of all, we've been saying to you that we have heated storage.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that we need to, obviously, the changing the lower unit oil is something we just discovered that we need. Is there anything else when you've got heated storage that you should do? Because really, I mean, it comes in here and nothing's going to freeze. Nothing's going to happen over the 5 months that it's up on, inside.
You know, the only thing you want to think of is you're trying to replicate the environment it's in when you're using it, right? And generally what that means is there's moist items left in the boat. That you need to clear. Because if it's sitting in a seal, you know, the boats are made very well nowadays. The compartments that say are sealed, they're sealed. And when you leave something moist in there, it creates mildew and stuff that nobody wants that grows things. So, I would just say making sure all your wet items are out of there. And other than that, no, the boat's okay at that point. Stabilizing the fuel still because it's sitting, you know, and it's not, again, it's above zero. So it's worse than fuel sitting than if it was a blow. So yeah, things like that, but no.
Okay.
He reminded me, I don't know if you remember this, Ange. We, and one of our old Prince crafts, it was in the summertime. We had it outside of the old shop and we had a cover on it and we had all the compartments closed and there was mildew in there and hadn't used it for, I don't know why it was a certain amount of time, but we opened up, remember opening up those things and the life jackets were covered in mold?
Yeah, covered in mold. Yeah.
Like not everything was, but these life jackets, there was other things. It was nasty. I mean, we had to throw all this stuff out. So that can be expensive too. Yeah. You know, the mold or the mildew that happens and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So that's something you always got to be cautious of too.
No, you're right. It's actually coincidental to the point on cost. The first items that are susceptible to mildew seem to be your safety items.
Isn't that wild?
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah. Like I hate to say the kid's like toy water gun that is made of mostly plastic. It just wipes off. It's fine.
Yeah.
But your expensive life jacket is like, the water gun was $10 and the life jacket was $100. No,
yeah.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. So
I was talking to a mechanic a couple of years ago and we were talking about boats that are brought in. Of course, everybody wants their boat ready for the thaw, right? In the spring, they want to be the first in line. And of course, there's usually thousands of boats ahead of them. But I remember this story. This one time, the guy told me that he had a boat come in early in the year, and it had lost power. They put a new battery. They checked all the. And what it ended up happening was that a mouse had been eating away at one of the return power lines and it just caused all kinds of havoc in their service. Wow. Mice apparently are one of the biggest factors. When you have an electronic item that's not working on a boat, after, especially after it's been stored for the winter, mice usually are the culprits. What is up with that?
They love the, from what I understand, it's the glue and the wiring. One of the resins. They really like.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
No, they're pretty attracted to it. It is an issue, to be truthful. Like, you know, in the industry, we're just all cognizant of it. And, you know, we do what we can to have anti-deterrent systems for it. I mean, they're, you know, I suspect your next question is, when you're at home and you store it yourself, what do? There's a million old wives' tales of, you know, mothballs, bounce sheets, like endless things. I mean, the nice thing about the bounce sheets is they at least smell good after it.
Well, he gave me a little tip. He gave me a little tip, and I was going to mention that.
Put a cat in there.
Well, that would be ideal. First of all, the minute you cover something, you're making a potential, you're building a whole community base for mice.
Yep.
Because they want cover in the winter as well, right? So it's perfect. So one of the things that he said that works extremely well, aside from bounce, aside from mothballs, which don't smell too good in the spring when you open things up, is peppermint. Peppermint spray that you can buy at, you know, a health store or beauty store, wherever they sell all the little scents, oil-based scents. Well, you take that and you put it in a mister, a bottle, with a spray top, and you dilute it by 50% with water, and you spray all of your wiring that is exposed or that you can reach with this stuff, and mice be gone. What? He says it's an amazing. Well, in fact, I tried it myself, not on the boat, but in another area where I had a mouse issue, and it works really well.
Really?
Extremely well. And it's biodegradable. It's not harmful. It's just the scent. Peppermint. So remember that. Peppermint. Get some peppermint in the boat if you're going to cover it up in the winter and leave it outside or inside.
That's a great tip.
Yeah.
I like that.
There you go. Steve learned something too. I love it. I'm teaching the teacher.
I love it, man. I've heard of peppermint for a couple other things, actually, but never in that application. That's great.
And the best thing is the York peppermint patties and you're snacking when you're out and you're fishing and snack. The best.
There you go.
They're the best. We just had them about 2 weeks ago. We just ate a ton of them. Oh, my God. It was horrible.
All right, Steve, let's talk a little bit about this new group that you work with. If we could quickly just mention, how many marinas are involved in this?
19.
Wow. 19.
Good. And,
but each marina still maintains its own name, like Gordon Bay still is Gordon Bay Marine.
Yep. So all the properties keep their branding and, you know, the culture. You know, we retain a huge amount of the staff. We're thankful for that as well. We just try to provide support and scalability to the individual properties. That's really our goal.
From a consumer standpoint, what's in it for me? Where's the consumer going to benefit?
You have a large support network now. You know, all these marinas would have been competing with each other before. And now, as a customer, you're just part of our family. So it doesn't matter where you are. We're going to take care of you. And you're going to have prioritized service as a result.
So you would, if you needed a part and didn't have it at one marina, you call the other marine over there. Boom, they can get to you within a day sort of thing or something instead of waiting for weeks or even, months.
I mean, we have mobile parts vans running around. We have mobile technicians. We're pretty in connection with each other. So, I mean, you know, it's even still operated almost on a family basis to a degree in the sense of like, you know, one employee just knows the other employee from, you know, interacting before we own the group. And it's like, oh, that guy's going to need this. I'll run it on the way home. Like it's a really unique culture in the sense that we get to, you know, leverage the size of the organization, but we still do run it like a family company. It's really unique that way. And I think it's fitting for the industry because at the end of the day, you know, most of these people are coming up to, you know, their boat is their home or their cottage away from home or their cottages, their cottage away from home. And, you know, I don't think they want to be put into a very overly regimented corporate environment.
Right.
And obviously for new products too, like new boats and new motors, now all of a sudden you can draw from 19 different locations.
If
you're looking 100%. For a Merc motor or, you know, whatever you're looking for, right?
Yeah, like we carry 26 different boat brands and it doesn't matter, you know, which marina you're at. If that, you know, marina doesn't carry that particular boat brand, you can still get it through us and we support it as if you did buy it from that marina. It's, you know, it's kind of all the benefits and freedoms together we try to think of.
Hey, Steve, through the summertime, this is just a thought just come over my head. Mm-hmm. You're in your service servicing of boats, motors, whatever like that, do you get more people that bring the boats to the marinas, or do you get more of you guys go to the cottage to service a boat?
Wow.
Yes. It's a great question. It would depend, like, you know, of the 19 marinas, three or four of them would be more they're going and servicing the boat, you know, at the place for the people. Wow. Then, you know, three or four would be it's all coming into them. Then the other three or four would be they're servicing the boat, you know, in the water in their slip, but at our marina because the boats are, you know,
right,
60 to 100 feet. So, you know, you get a wide range between a 12-foot Prince Craft with a 9.9 on it to, like, you know, a 75-foot Sunseeker that, you know, you can house two families on basically comfortably. Yeah. So, yeah. Cool. Wide range.
That's the whole concept of it's like a doctor making house calls.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
To have a mechanic go to a cottage.
That's pretty cool.
Well, that's craziness. In terms of pricing structure, because obviously you have a lot of folks, probably the majority, especially during these times, they want to go price shopping. They want to see where the best deals are. Having a group this big, is that good or bad for the consumer, in your opinion?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good question. You know, there's certain things that we can offer scalability on as a larger group that we couldn't as a smaller group, which, you know, inherently would pass those savings on to our, you know, clients, customers. But at the same time, there's other cost items that don't change with scaling, truthfully. And, you know, that puts us in the same place as a smaller business operating. So I think really it's about the customer's experience now. And I mean, I think the manufacturers are, you know, not in any way trying to wean out mom and pop shops by any means, but just say, hey, you know, if you want to carry our product lines, you know, we expect you to provide the consumer with a certain experience. And this experience is going to need, no matter what you say, this level of investment. So if you're willing to make this level of investment, you want to make the experience great, then they want to partner with you. And so, you know, we're trying to do that. I mean, we ask that our clients, you know, try to give us as much of their business as they can through sales, parts, service, all of it, right? But at the same time, we understand that's got to be rewarded. You know, that kind of loyalty is deeply appreciated.
Interesting. Speaking of reward, is there a loyalty card or anything that you guys are going to be?
Yeah, so we have a loyalty program we're working on, but, you know, each individual marina, you know, has different markets in which it operates in, which allow different levels of revenue. So, I mean, it's not as widespread as, say, like, you know, a McDonald's rewards program but there is rewards for the individual clients at each marina. And then there are certain rewards that are more of a blanket throughout the network.
Is it a coincidence or just a matter of good timing that this has all taken place immediately post pandemic? Because, and the reason I ask that, because as we know, during the pandemic, things were insane in this industry, whether it was boats or outboard motors. I mean, it was totally insane. In the 40 years that we've been in business, I've never seen it so volatile. It was crazy. The pandemic ends and things seem to have settled down a little bit. Is this group a direct connection to the pandemic, or was it just coincidental?
No, I mean, great question. I mean, so I guess the answer would be coincidental in the sense I think it was more, and I'll answer this question more as Steve from my previous roles than I would as my current one. But I think it was more just the general age demographic of the owner operators from within this industry in Ontario and maybe, you know, maybe even Canada. I mean, you could see it already in the U.S. happening, you know, when groups like One Water started, or even like, you know, Safe Harbor, a lot of what they were buying was just people who were not succeeding it to their kids or their family. They just wanted to get out for a variety of reasons, age, you know, done it, been there, like, who knows, right? I think that, you know, Canada always tends to follow the U.S. markets a bit. And I think that's all that it was we were already on this kind of, like, there was an opportunity with so much succession going on in the place, you know, the market we operate in. And it was like, let's do this. And then at the same time, the pandemic did happen. So, you know, and I think the pandemic was obviously great for boating, but I believe in Catibus Paribus, which all things are going to be equal. So I'm sure we're going to feel a bit of the slow from it too. I mean, I think that overall the industry will have grown a little bit from it, even when it normalizes again, which is great news for us. And, you know, I'm excited that more people, truthfully, younger people are getting into boating. I mean, I do what I do because I was put on a boat when I was months old. And the first thing I did with my kid when they were born was put them on a boat. So I sincerely hope for people my age and younger that they want to do the same thing.
Is it compare? How could we compare right now, post pandemic, to pre pandemic? Is it better now still, or
you're talking from what sense?
Sales, like you said, boat sales went nuts. Boating went crazy in the pandemic. So how was it before the pandemic, and how is it now in comparison? Is that a weird question? Yep. Maybe I don't know.
No, it's a good question. I think it denies my theory a little bit in the sense that, you know, it was okay, then it got great, and I think it's okay again. But in theory, it should be maybe not okay for a bit because it was great. But no, everything still seems to be tracking okay. And it was like before the pandemic. I mean, it was, you know, it's a professional level industry. You come, it's like playing a real game of hockey. You're not playing shinny. You're coming to work to do your thing and compete and do what you can. But, you know, nobody was starving and nobody was hitting the high notes. It was a lot of fun in a great industry. And I think we're back to that now after going through greatness, but that also caused a, you know, it was a lot of work and it was a bit of a gamble in certain points. Sometimes you're just like, do I do this? Do I not do this?
Supply during the pandemic, of course, one of the problems was that we had a great amount of interest in the marine industry in general. I can only equate it to the fishing industry, obviously, but there was a great amount of interest developed during the pandemic. But unfortunately, the pandemic also crippled our ability to manufacture and ship product. So it was kind of a little bit lopsided, more demand than supply. Where are we now with supply in the marine industry?
Yes, everything's basically normalized again. I mean, we have inventory on the ground. We don't have, you know, too much, too little. It's all pretty normal again. I would say we're just in the years, you know, that were reflective right before the pandemic. Everything is kind of just status quo, which the weird thing is that seems weird, right? People are like, how can it be normal? I don't know. And you're like, it feels weird for me that it's normal.
So you're saying that if I want to go out and buy a Merc or a boat package right now, I don't have to worry about facing
year and
the
a half
fact
wait
that,
or
exactly,
two year wait
I can go
like
out right now and to go to any of your marinas and sit down and either order and get delivery of a product in relatively close time frame, or better yet, I can go in and I know that there's a ton of inventory and I can actually pick and choose.
Yeah, I mean, I would answer somewhere in the middle on that. I mean, yes, you could definitely, you know, we have this joke. It's like, you want a boat? It's like a pizza. We'll get it to you in 20 minutes or there's a problem for you. Like it's, you know, So, I mean, for the 80% of that, you're probably okay, but there are still consumers that want to customize their orders and have exactly what they've always dreamed about. And, you know, that's an awesome thing. And there is a bit of a hangover still from the supply chain on certain items, right? So like if you wanted to order exact model of an exact thing with a certain option, you might still be like, you know, a year out or half a year or something like that. Or if it's a really large boat that they can only make so many of a year, you could still be maybe even 2 years out on that wait list. Okay. But if you want something that I would say the average consumer, average family person wants to use, and you're looking for a bit of a deal, there is inventory on the ground now. And if you're willing to sacrifice that it's black versus red or whatever, you'll get a good deal. You'll get the boat right now. And, you know, you'll be spending those years out in the water.
Beauty.
Does somebody call a central number and say, hey, I've got a cottage on Rice Lake and I'm looking to buy a 20-foot aluminum boat or fiberglass, whatever it happens to be, and I want a red one, and then you guys kind of go through your network? Yes.
Good business question. We try to kind of split the difference in the sense that each property again runs its own individual brand, and you know they have their respective clients that they deal with. If a consumer is new, it would be you come in through the marina through a referral website, you know, many different avenues. But if you're using the approach you just said exactly, they would go to more the Maple Leaf website or call the Maple Leaf information line, and the information would be directed to, hey, this is the brand that you're looking for, and this, you know, we have multiple stores. Where are you located? Okay, well, this is the brand that's carried in that closest store. And then they could say, hey, we want another brand, but that is our closest store. No problem. We offer these other 26, you know, 25 brands. We're happy to help you with any of them through that store. So I guess what I'm trying to say is we try not to make it as almost traditional sales process. It is a little bit more customized, and, you know, we're able to be that flexible because we have this wide network of marinas under our portfolio that nobody really has in Ontario before.
Coming up very shortly will be the usual boat show season, where consumers are going out looking for a bargoon, and they maybe have been looking for a package from their home marina, but they wait until the shows kick in and in during the winter period because they want a better deal. And you've been involved in this when you know with Gordon Bay, where a consumer outside of your jurisdiction comes in to bargain with you for a better price on a popular model. The big fear there has always been, and I always tell people when they ask me, you know, should I buy a boat at one of these shows or should I go to the marina in my on my home lake and give them the business? And my answer is always clear. But from my standpoint, and it's probably not always the right standpoint, from my standpoint is why wouldn't you give the business to your local marina? Because in the moment of need, and we've all been there before, wouldn't it be nice to go to a friendly face that you recognize and say, hey, I bought this boat from you last year or 2 years ago. It's leaking.
Better yet, they recognize you.
Exactly.
And they say, hey, Angelo, hey, come on in, buddy.
But, but we know, you know, that every year, thousands of people are going to go to the shows and they're going to kick tires and get the very best save a couple hundred bucks and buy from a dealer that they will never see again. True. What do you think of that? What's your opinion of that?
Well, you know, my opinion is maybe a little bit biased because I'm very much a local business guy and I've always been in what we call a destination dealership, not a, you know, centralized city dealership. So I would always say buy where you vote. That's what it's always been to me.
Yeah. But you've been against it. You've been up against it at these shows. I mean,
I've been up against it. And by the same token, I get the guy on the other side of the fence that's not on this call needs to earn a living too. So I'm trying not to be like, say, overly biased. But I think the real thing to me is, and, you know, maybe use Maple Leaf as a small example here, is you have a smaller one of our marinas that, you know, doesn't, let's say they carry Prince Craft and, you know, the competing dealer carries like a smoker craft type thing or something. I mean, I think you really want to just buy, you know, their level products to a degree. I think you want to buy the product from your home marina where you're slipping, you're storing, and, you know, they're providing you with that service. If you use the same situation, let's say somebody's buying like a Malibu or a Mastercraft, I mean, these things are, you know, fairly advanced and expensive creature. You know, in our case, that would come from the dealership that sells it, and we would support it through that smaller marina that we own as well. But knowing that a lot of the technology, the infrastructure, the training on the for the tax, like everything is really coming from that home marina. So if you take the same situation and you say now that delivering marina is the Malibu is coming through that smoker craft dealer, it's going to be hard because now you're really, you know, that marina can't handle fixing this high-end complex device you've purchased. And now you're going to have another marina coming into that marina's backyard and they're going to start to have friction.
Wow.
So,
wow. Interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say it's, you know, doing the research isn't coming like in the sense that you want to know what you're buying, what the technology is, the service cycles and things like that. And you want to know if the marina you deal with can support that or not. So, you know, biasly, I would say, again, in that situation, if you're buying one of those products and it's through a smaller marina and there's an option to deal with us, it might be worth looking into because, you know, you're getting that full line backing as if you bought it from the big marina, but you still supported your local smaller marina. In other cases where we're not there and there's a small marina and, you know, the client totally wants this type of boat, you know, you almost want to reach out to your local marina and say, hey, I'm buying this. You don't carry it. And I'm going to be dealing with this dealer on it. Do you have a decent relationship with them? Could you work with them? Because I just want to ensure this product is always doing what it needs to for my family. Yeah. And, you know, the marine industry is small. We all do work together to a degree. And, you know, we always, all of us share the common goal of let's get people out boating and have them smiling and make sure they keep doing that.
Yeah. It's something to for people listening here too, to take note of when Andrew's talking about the boat show. We've noticed this with, of course, the Prince Craft. So if you're looking to buy a Prince Craft, you go to the boat show, you go to the Prince Craft booth, and in that booth, you're looking and you see the model you like, whatever. Hey, I like this boat. You start talking to somebody, and then usually the representatives from a ton of marinas are there. A lot of Prince Craft dealers are, you know, are at the show. So they can say, hey, Bill, you live in Cobourg, Ontario? Okay, we got a dealer right here like that. Hey, Bill, come on over here, just meet John. You know, and then they set you up like that with a local dealer, and then you can really set up something that, that gets close to your lake again or your home again.
Maybe.
Right? So, well, that's what they try to do.
Maybe.
Well, you know.
That would be the perfect world.
That's in
right?
a perfect world. Yeah.
So, but.
Can I go back to a question of the storage and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. Steve, Sure. This is one that's often asked a lot by anglers, I guess. I don't know any fishermen, but anglers. Your batteries, your trolling motor and starting batteries. You store your boat. Should you be pulling those? If it's outside, I'm assuming you pull the batteries out and put them inside somewhere. Or if it's inside, what do we do for storing batteries and charging through the wintertime?
So good question. Batteries can't freeze. If they freeze, they're toast. I mean, you know, hybrid cars, electric plug-in cars, it's the same thing. The heater is going the whole time to keep everything warm, right? You
can't let batteries freeze. Wow.
So other than that, you know, just don't put it on concrete. Concrete will suck them dry as well. They should be on, you know, if you can put them on a maintainer, that is a good thing. Even if, you know, you've got four batteries and you got all four batteries in your shed or your garage where, they, you know, they won't freeze and you got one maintainer, even just swapping it between them every couple of weeks type thing is fine. So they just don't sulfur up inside. I mean, it also depends on the battery. You know, there are, you know, there's lithium, there's gel, there's lead acid. Like there's a lot of different categories that people still use in our industry. And they will probably be there for a while. Like I imagine lead acid will get cycled out of the auto industry way before it does with the marine industry. So I think it's just knowing what type of battery you have, knowing that none of them can freeze and knowing that a bit of maintenance doesn't hurt them. That's for sure.
Okay. So if we have our boats in this garage here, not going to use them from all December, January, February, March, should we take off the wires? Could we leave it hooked up?
Oh yeah. Yeah. You got to disconnect them from the system for sure. I mean,
is the shut off?
The other thing is, I mean, if you don't have a battery switch, you get one of those mice in there. You don't want them everything being live if they choose something, right?
True.
If you turn off the main power, most boats today have got a major power switch.
Battery switch, disconnect.
They would still be okay if you turn that off. The battery still hooked up would be fine, would they not?
Yeah, they would be. I mean, I still disconnect them truthfully would on you? My own. It's just my practice. I believe they should be disconnected, but.
Wow.
Most situations, like in heated storage, probably not. I'd leave it in the off position. But in most situations, the batteries need to come out of the boats anyway. Other than heated storage, it's going to freeze. So,
right.
Something to take note of, and it happened to me yesterday here on our boat, Ange, is lithium batteries often go into a sleep mode as well. So I went to start it up because I wanted to get some waypoints out of the GPS, and it wouldn't even turn on. I thought, wow. So I put the charger on it. Within 2 minutes, everything was back to full charging. And I'm thinking, wow. So, but they go to sleep. So the battery systems in these boats now they're much more complex than what it used to be.
You and I went through that in the initial stages of switching over to lithium.
Absolutely.
A few times we were shocked. What the hell's going on? Remember?
They can't be dead.
Yeah. And now we know that those computers will become inactive. And sometimes it's not just being shut down for a period of time. Sometimes it'll just go inactive.
Yeah.
And it takes a bit of a shock to bring it seems to bring them back to life.
So anyway.
Electronics. So the big thing today is we just mentioned it, is to have a great big one of those big red switches, and at the end of the day you turn that baby off and you don't have to worry about you don't have to worry about all of this stuff you got on your boat that's draining constantly. That hasn't been the case. Maybe the last 3 or 4 years maximum, but prior to that we didn't have those switches and we were constantly waking up to dead batteries. Is that a practice that you would suggest a boat owner that's, let's say he's got a 5-year-old boat, something that you suggest taking it into the dealership and having this switch installed, or maybe even do it themselves if they're handy? It's not like these boats were okay without one, and now all of a sudden they all have to have one. The old boats need one, in my opinion, as well.
I agree. There's multiple things here. There's an industry correction because truthfully, we're all putting so many batteries in every year because there was no switch and they just killed this battery die. So no, they should all have battery switches. That's why they do part of the reason they do now. You can get different levels of battery switches. So, you know, just a 5-year-old boat, putting just a main disconnect in for sure. I mean, especially, this is what I was going to say. If you're adding electronics, you should really have it. I mean, if you actually power up the electronics, turn off the battery switch, you can count to like three or four Mississippis before everything dies. These things are holding a lot of voltage in their systems. You know, and they should be drained and shut down properly. They're not like a laptop or a computer that we all use every other day. And if it's in sleep mode, it's at least getting woken up on a daily basis. These things are for weeks, months. So they should be turned off properly. So yeah, no, I 100% agree with it. And you know, they're getting more advanced in the sense like a car, like if, you know, you have a basic one and then you have ones that are completely automatic and ones that actually work off, telemedics. So like you get notifications on your phone and eventually the system will just turn the actual battery switch off in an automated fashion so that even the telemedics are not drawing on it anymore. It's like, okay, the battery's down to like 50% now. We got to run bilge pumps. Like, you know, I'm going to stop giving you messages that your oil chains do now because it's, you know, priority.
We interrupt this program to bring you the much-anticipated bonus code for the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. This week's code is LIFEJACKET. That's LIFEJACKET. LIFEJACKET. Just type that in the bonus code section of the contest and receive 100 free entries towards all our current giveaways. For those who haven't entered yet, what the heck are you waiting for? Head on over to fishingcanada.com while you listen to the rest of this episode. Click contests and sign up for all the latest Fishing Canada giveaways. And now, back to the show.
Yeah.
Which brings me to another question about electronics. So Pete and I have a friend who recently had a horrific experience at a marina. Not one of yours, so you could relax. We're not going to hit you with this one. Where he took an older boat in for a complete refurbishing of electronics. And the marina, the dealer, obviously at some point said, yeah, we can do that job. So they did. And he picked the boat up and it was terrible. So he questioned the marina and said, yeah, but guys, like, shouldn't this be here? And shouldn't this be like, he had a little bit of knowledge, right?
Right.
And they said, no, we know what we're doing kind of thing. And so he ended up calling me and saying, can you help? So Pete and I went out with him one day this summer to have a look and see exactly what had happened. And I got to tell you, Steve, it was an embarrassment. It was an awful job. Obviously, the person who did that, this must have been his first time at it. The reason I'm right. making this comment to you is because electronics have gotten to a point today where it's not just a simple little plug and play. These systems are very advanced. And when you start coupling them up with, you know, second and third and fourth and fifth units on the same boat that are all networking and interconnected and Bluetooth, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. There has to be a certain amount of expertise involved in installing them. Do you think the marina industry now that, you know, obviously they're starting to form into groups like you guys will at some point do some training? Because these poor mechanics that have been, you know, working on outboards for the last 25 years, they don't know anything about the new electronics unless they are users, right? Unless they personally are out there with a boat that's got four or five screens on it. So if you don't already have something in place, I'd like to suggest that maybe somebody start some kind of course for these mechanics who are going to be involved in wiring these boats up to maybe get a little more expertise into the system.
For sure. So, I mean, you know, we do that as MLM internally. If you go to our website, you'll see we have an apprentice program and everything. So, you know, I think the real answer to this question is maybe more a bit financially direct. You get what you pay for. You know, right. We're not always going to be the cheapest on service, but we send our technicians to school every year. They go specifically to factory training. It costs us a fortune, you know, and you're investing in your people, and that's the best thing you can do. And they're going to do the job right. But we, as result, have to charge for it. So I would say, you know, getting a great deal is always important for sure for everybody. And every buck they earn is, you know, dear to them, and, you know, they should get as much as they can for it. But what I'm saying, getting as much as you can, you know, it doesn't do any good to pay $120 an hour to have what you just did, you could pay $139 an hour and it was done perfectly.
Right.
Does that difference really make a difference to you in the end? Yeah, probably yeah. not.
No, yeah, absolutely.
Right. So we have the largest network of technicians, both in shops and on the road mobily, and they all go through training, whether it be ABYC training, which is more of call it like the Marine electrician standard, or whether they go through specific training like a Malibu or a Mastercraft or a Cobalt, or like there's, right. you know, right. And like I said, being really under the hood, the training for these staff members is very expensive because the boat factories are in the hardest places possibly to fly to for, I'm sure, tax no advantage kidding. Reasons for yeah, them, right? Yeah, so yeah. It's hard for a smaller marina to, you know, it's not like, hey, am I going to make a $2,000-$3,000 investment in this person? It's like, you know, yearly, you're talking 10 plus in a person easily. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot for a smaller wow. business to, you know, stomach whether they're going to really get into it. So I think you're just going to see more division in the sense that there's going to be, you know, shops that do basic things and they're probably okay with that and everybody will pay. But after that, I don't know, if right. I'm spending $5,000-$10,000 on electronics in my boat, I'm happy to pay the $150 an hour versus $130 exactly. to know it's done right. Exactly. And if something isn't done right, odds are that company is going to back it and correct it anyway.
You know, there's even to the point now, it's great that Ange mentioned this, in the U.S., and I don't think it's in Canada yet, but in the U.S., they have actually started companies that just wire boats. That's it. You get your yeah. boat, you buy your brand new boat. Now you're going to put five Garmins on it, bring it in here. We're going to bring the Garmins with it. You know what I mean? So maybe Steve's Marinas can take note of that. But what I was going to say is I looked at it this morning. It was funny you say this because I looked at it this morning and there's even to the point now where they're building custom wiring harnesses for
in the boats?
Bass boats. Yeah. Or that they add in. So these are aftermarket. And some of these wiring harnesses, believe it or not, if you're running five graphs, a couple of live scopes, et cetera, just the wiring is $500 or $600 alone.
That's cheap.
For that stuff. But
that's
well,
cheap.
It sounds, to us, it's cheap. To anybody else, I could run a number 14 through there. No. You know, but they have harnesses, they have Y cables, they have brake, and they tie it into mm-hmm. your Garmin, you know, tails, pigtails. They fuse it properly, the whole nine yards. Yeah. So it's an intricate bunch of work right now.
So are you saying right now I could go online and I go someplace and say, I've got a 21-foot Prince Craft, yep. and I'm going to put 3 8,600 Garmin units at the helm. I'm going to put this at the back and one of those at the front, and they will actually
build you a custom harness for that. I'm telling you, this is organic, people.
Wow.
Listening, because I did it this morning. I put it in there.
What a breakthrough,
man. I said, different brands. You could put a Garmin, a Humminbird, and Lowrance up front, and blah, 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 and then two more on the console and all that. I built it, just was partnering around with all that. And yeah, and they custom it. That's going to cost you $50 more. That's going to cost you $75 more. Boom, 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 boom. Yeah. But
that's
but what else they showed us in that is that when they started, they showed it on a 21-foot Phoenix bass boat. When they started, they had 12.9 volts at the battery. Each graph was at least a volt down already at the mm-hmm. console. At the front, they were down even more than that from the voltage drop for the wiring and all that. And then yeah. they put the new wiring in, and it was all perfect. Ooh. So
balance, it's balanced.
It made a difference. So yeah. I mean, when you pay, like Steve's saying, you pay for quality. You pay for somebody that knows what they're doing. It makes a big difference. So
huge.
Yeah, and like just a, you know, nitty gritty point in our industry is most automotive stuff and power sports, the connector can only go into one connector.
Right.
In marine, it does not work like that.
No.
Right.
You can put ground into ground or
yeah.
voltage
yeah.
into voltage.
Yeah.
So
right.
even with these custom wiring harnesses, they can make it as good as they want, but what you might be plugging into maybe where the flaw is.
Yep.
So again, having yep. someone who actually understands that wiring diagram and the system that's being
Absolutely.
Adapted to is still good. And also, you're right, voltage loads. A lot of people load these things up and they forget the voltage loads change. And even where the wire harness is feeding voltage, you know, it could be a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like you might not have the right gauge of wire to get from the batteries that are at the back of the boat up to the graph at the very front of the
that's
boat,
right.
but it going to the console is enough. You
yep.
know what I mean?
Exactly.
I don't know whether you're aware of it or not, Steve, but there is a big need out there for that. Right now you talk to 10 anglers that are building a boat, meaning they've bought a boat. Now they're going to build it to their specs in terms of electronics. The biggest weakness that they have right now is finding a place that has the credentials to be able to wire these things up and make them work flawlessly. So it's something that, if you're not aware of it, something that you might keep in mind as this Maple Leaf group grows, that maybe, you know, I mean, I'd love for you
retail
to say
electronics warehouse, right?
Well, I'd love for you to say to me right now, we got it covered. Tell them to call 1-800 and we will look after them. That would be great. But as Pete just mentioned, the U.S. is way ahead of us in terms of that, right? So, maybe something that we should look at because we're starting to get a little more, you know, we're not all wooden dinghies around anymore.
Yeah, they might be bass boat oriented, but we are walleye, muskie, bass, you know what I mean? There's all kinds of boats that all run the same layout, basically. Yeah. So, yeah.
Speaking of which, let's just for one quick moment turn our attention to what Pete just said. They may be more bass-oriented south of the border, but our requirements for boats, because of the variety of species, that freshwater species that we fish for, you know, might not be necessarily good platforms to work with bass boats. I know when Pete and I were into tournaments and bass fishing on a full-time basis, all we could think about was big, beautiful, glittery, glass, smooth, slippery, wonderful bass boats. Okay. That was not, we did a reality check and we discovered that's not the reality here in Canada. Has the bass boat made any headway at all up here? Or for the most part, are we still aluminum boat bound?
Yeah, I think we're still aluminum boat bound. I think the bass boat, definitely has its market for sure. It's just, it's a very small market in the sense of the guy that's willing to put on the Mustang survival suit to go out boating on a day like today versus someone who can just sit in what we're wearing and, you know, even without a heater or in a heater in a dual console, more style fishing boat. So I also think bass boats are hard for a family, truthfully. And I think a large portion of our consumers are still family boaters. So it's just more inherent to buy like a fish and ski from Prince Craft type thing, like a holiday or something, that it would be a bass boat. Mm.
Interesting.
Right, good point. Interesting. And your opinion of glass versus, because you sell a lot of glass boats in your group.
We sell a lot of both.
Both. But if you were comparing the two, can you give our listener a little bit of advice on when to look at aluminum versus fiberglass, or is there a point anymore?
I don't know. You could make this argument that I'm like the guy that's like, I'm not getting rid of my V8 big block pickup truck, even though this 4-cylinder twin turbo is still more efficient. Like, and I guess my answer to that is I'm a bit of a fiberglass guy, but I think aluminum really does make a lot more sense in a lot of ways, but I'm a fiberglass guy. So I think you'll get a different answer from every boat person you ask that question to, whether the market they're in, whether they're a veteran boat guy or new boat guy. Like I think it's still a pretty big spray effect answer to that question. But yeah, I would think that aluminum has made more advancements than fiberglass has recently. That's the way I'd answer the question.
For sure. We've noticed that like Ann says, we used to run fiberglass boats all the time. Of course, with Prince Craft this many years, we've run aluminum so many years and yeah, they've come a long way. Aluminum boats have come a long way. That's for sure.
We had both. I mean, for the most part, we ran, for our own personal use because we were into tournaments and bass fishing and all that stuff. We had to have bass boats for that. Mm-hmm. But on the show, it's been Prince Craft since the beginning of time.
Yeah.
And so we've had the luxury of having our butts in both boats. And I think for the most part, the glamour and glitz aside, although Alumina Boat Companies are starting to get awfully close to that glamour and glitz.
The new Prince Craft line for next year, it looks pretty spectacular.
It looks pretty good, doesn't it? Yeah,
so,
for sure.
So I think that advantage is gone now. And performance-wise, I mean, what we've done with FNC1, we've taken an aluminum Prince Craft hull and turned it into this piece of machinery that we've broken away from the mold of aluminum boats being slow and sluggish to aluminum boats being holy crap.
Totally. And I think the look too, like the look has come a long way.
They do. Remember when we went to the East Coast this year, they had our exact boat. They had the Expedition 200, our new one. And Remember the guys from Quebec? They had decked up. That thing was a gorgeous looking machine. It sat there. Steve, this is the best. We've never seen this before. So you got your two slips, your two docks, right? You got your for two boats to go in there. Well, these guys, they like their boats so much, they pulled it right in the center and they tied off both corners like this. It was sitting in the middle of all the slips.
It was the coolest looking thing I've ever seen. They said, "The hell with it, I'm taking the whole space."
And they had it all black. They had a Garmin trolling motor on the front. They had a Merc on the back and everything. They had some black power poles in the back. And it was cool. It's a cool looking. They're so nice and modern looking. So is there? This is a good question. I think now let's compare fiberglass fishing boats to aluminum fishing boats. Is there a price difference? Is there a lot of price difference? The variables?
Yeah, I mean, the fiberglass fishing boat's just more money, but that's not, I think, how do I phrase this? Sorry. So if you look at, let's say, a Prince Craft offering where, you know, you have a starting point and then you have the highest end point. Mm-hmm. In the fiberglass world, that's split. So in other words, the price point, let's say fiberglass fishing boat is more going to be like a Bayliner center console, let's say. Whereas say the upside to that side is more a, you know, bass boat. That's a little bit more expensive and costs what that higher end of the Prince Craft line is. So, you know, pricing for the aluminum, you're in the kind of same product the whole way through. Whereas in the fiberglass and the fishing, it's more, you know, unless, of course, you go to, let's say, like a Boston Whaler or Grady White, then yes, that's going to be a lot more money on that fiberglass side of fishing. But the specific, you know, smaller fishing boats, let's call anywhere from 14 to 22 feet. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're looking to spend $200,000 on a 20 footer, you're going to be buying a fiberglass, you know, bass boat. If you're looking to spend $50,000-$60,000 on a fiberglass boat that's under 20 feet, you're going to be, you know, into more like a Bayliner.
Right. You know, as he said that number, $200,000 for a bass boat.
By the way, people listening, that's a reality nowadays. It's real. In this day and age.
I'll tell you, one of my bucket list things this year, I had the privilege of riding on a couple million dollar 47-foot Grady White with 4/4 25s on it. And
oh my God.
You want to talk fishing boat? This thing was pretty epic.
Oh.
What is a 4/25 Merc worth? Was it a Merc? I'm assuming they were Mercs, you said?
These ones are actually Yamahas, but so 425, like 400 Merc or 425 Yamaha. I mean, yeah, Merc still does build the biggest guys, those 600s. I mean,
okay, what's the price tag on a 600? You got to know approximately. What's the price tag on that 600?
Oh man, the motor itself's like $100,000. Like I was on a 54-foot Scout that had 3 600s on it, I think. It was incredible. Like the motor advancements Mercury has done with just the lower unit changing or turning so that the motors can be much closer together so you can get more motors and more horsepower in the back of these outrageously cool offshore center consoles. Yeah, it's pretty spectacular. Wow.
You mentioned Merc, so that was going to be a later question, but we might as well go there right now. I know Merc has been secretly developing a whole range of electric motors. How long before we sort of look at the electric motors being maybe not the norm, but certainly gaining in popularity? Because right now it's totally it's out there. What's your opinion on that?
I think electric motors like I'm not a Brunswick strategist by any means, but I would say that, the path for the manufacturers is probably more in the commercial recreational segment. So meaning tour boats and things like that. Like if they can find the things that are operated on a daily basis to get them to go electric, similar to following what the pattern of the public transportation with buses are, you know what I mean? Get those on electric first, because at the end of the day, you know, a 115 Merc, it's not really burning that much fuel. It's not really hurting the environment, especially for how much the user is actually using it. Right. And the amount of infrastructure, like how do you say we'd have to put into place to make all those 16-foot, 90-horsepower boats become electric, I think we're actually probably hurting the environment more to put charging and power lines and everything into where it's never even had to plug before than we are just by burning a tank of fuel with our family in that 115 Merc. But you know, a commercial operation that's running four of them a day on a, you know, boat for parasailing or things like this, like even fishing tours where it's like, you know, you're coming back to a spot that has the infrastructure to charge that boat overnight. It's going to be used for this amount of time in a day. There's someone that we always have planned to go get them if it, you know, there is an issue. Not to say you wouldn't do that with gas engines too. I think it's just that commercial recreational operation is more suited and ready to deal with the barriers from migrating from gas to electric.
Hmm. You know, it's not a bad idea, though, for the small ones, for that little 6 horsepower or something like that, when you watch them carrying it around and all that. Because then your charging issue is you plug it in at your dock, or you bring it into your house, or you bring the battery into your house and you plug it in at normal 110. You know what I mean? So that's not a bad idea for that, I guess. You know what I mean? If you wanted to plug it
in. No, I think it's great for the small stuff, too. And that's going, I guess, back to the point of it. It's really adjusting the approach to the existing infrastructure.
Right. Exactly.
So it's a pipe dream for me to think that in my
you have a Tesla on the water
in my lifetime that we would have a Princecraft XWP boat that you know the entire hull is a big battery, and I'm developing 600 horsepower out of this single thing that's hanging out the bottom of the back of the boat. That's sort of a pipe dream of mine.
I don't know, Angela. I mean, I really don't. It's a good question. I mean, and they're advancing real quick and stuff is happening. I mean, you know, I think the car industry took a different approach with hybrid. I mean, I haven't seen the marine industry do that yet, but I mean, there's an argument that hybrid really is, you know, great the whole way around. You think about it, it's like you're burning a little bit of fuel. It's charging an electric battery. That battery is also turning the wheels too. I mean, you know, maybe there's something there for the marine industry. I'm not too sure. I mean, you look at even the new propellers where they're trying to get more of like propellers in the sense that it's using one angle of the prop when it's, rotating at 6,000 RPM, whereas it's actually hitting another angle of the prop when it's rotating at 3,000 RPM. So I think there's a lot of options for efficiency in the marine industry. And I think we've got a lot of spectacular people working on it. What the path is, I don't know yet, but I don't think it's a pipe dream. I mean, from what we've seen, most advancements, it's like, you know, you could get 4 hours of lightweight boating out of a 20 plus foot boat on, you know, an overnight charge type thing. So I think you'd be around for it, man.
You mentioned props. In your opinion, and I'm not going to hold you to this, in your opinion, well, no, let's get off the opinion. Let me ask you a straightforward question. Is there a place right now that you know of where a person could take their performance boat and bring it in and leave it overnight for a day, a week, whatever the case may be, and that place has enough expertise to find the right prop for that particular boat? Because a lot of times, as you know, props are kind of, you know, most dealers, most manufacturers have got a general feel for a prop, but every boat is different. Every engine position on that boat is different, and it makes a huge difference to the right prop. Is there a place where we could take our boat right now and say, here you go, guys, I'll be back in a couple of days, put the right prop in that boat?
Yeah, for sure. Like any of our dealership style marinas could do that for you. The marine resort style ones just aren't dealing with boats, I would say, of that size. You know, they would be more looking at things like, for again, like a 52 footer to turn as much torque as possible, right? But, you know, high end, you know, speed performance on boats, let's say under 25 feet. Yeah, any of our dealership marinas could do that. The really cool thing, and this is, you know, one of the proud my belief moments, is every dealership that we had actually like their internal prop charts from experience, like just over the years, like, hey, the manufacturers, you know, they gave us these guidelines, but to your point, it's like, we found this was just, you know, that hair better in our water and this type of hull. So the cool thing with Maple Leaf is we have all of those from all of those marinas now. The individual prop viable for one marina is now multiplied over 9 or 10. And, you know, we have all the experienced technicians that help develop those documents. So I would like to say that we have as much insight to it as you could possibly have without having it on a, you know, digital test tank that someone like Brunswick or Yamaha would have.
Interesting. Because, you know, the problem with what Angie's saying, a lot of people are very, very concerned about getting the most out of their boat. The problem is, they say try a bunch of different props. Where are you going to get these props? I got to buy 10 stainless steel props at $1,000 each to try them and then try and sell them off afterwards. No, that's a ridiculous thought. But a place like, you know, what we're talking about here, they have multiple props. I'm sure they could even try. I would assume.
Oh right yeah, there. Like you know, Gordon Bay, Walker's Point, you know, Huntsville Marine, DeMaison. Like they're stocking hundreds of props at each location, and those locations I just named are all within 1 hour of each other. So even if one didn't have it and the other didn't, I mean, you know, in theory, one of our parts drivers could take it. But I mean, the consumer at that point, if they're as motivated as I am when I want to get some performance done, they'll drive an hour knowing it's still in the same. And you're not even like, you know, necessarily bugging one marina to the next. It's like, hey, we're giving the heads up that you're coming. Like, this is a project we're working on together and it's all good, right?
So I'm not looking for a freebie, but I'm going to put the challenge on you right now. This spring, I need to take FNC1 someplace, and I need to hand it over because I need an extra 200 RPM minimum out of the engine and the setup that we've got. And I know it's in the prop. I know that for a fact it's in the prop. But to Pete's case, we just don't, number one, we don't have the time. But number two, we don't have the inventory of props that it's going to take to fine tune it down to just one. So I can go to a marina, pay them whatever their rate is, and say, get that 200 RPM.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, got you on tape.
Yeah, no problem.
One final question, and we're going to let you go, Steve. You've given us more time than we asked for, so we appreciate it. But as we are closer to the reality of double-digit interest rates than we are to single-digit under 5% interest rates moving forward. Is there aspiration in the future boat buyer's life to think that maybe the boat industry, like the automobile industry, is going to come up with some relief on interest rates? Are they going to say, hey, you know what? This month only 0% interest for 48-month financing. Is that a reality at all in the boat business?
I think zero might be a stretch right now, but no, I mean, you know, under the hood again, we're doing what we can to lower rates from our side for the consumer. But one thing I would put as a comparison between the auto and us is our assets hold their value much stronger.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Across the board.
Interesting.
So, you know, when you're, you know, don't get me wrong, for lack of a better word, it is a mechanical product. It's a depreciating asset, but the depreciation scale is like very minimal in comparison to any automotive product. So, you know, it's not a house where you hope it's appreciating, but it's not far off in the sense of costing you. So, yeah, interest rates are hard for everyone, you know, all parts of life, but we're doing what we can to buy them down a bit for everybody. And like I said, you know, you're getting an asset that does not have a heavy depreciation scale.
Yeah, the problem with that, the asset thing makes sense. The asset part of it makes sense. But the problem is if we close in on that $200,000 barrier for most people, it's one thing to look at it at a low interest rate, but making that monthly payment at a high interest rate puts them out of the market.
It's an expensive boat.
Right. So, and that's why.
It's an expensive boat. I would agree. Yeah. And, we can help out on those a little bit more too. If you're looking at spending that kind of dollar amount,
okay.
Beauty.
All right. Well, that's very interesting. There you go. Steve, thank you so much. And if we could impose on you to come back on a more regular basis now that we've reconnected our relationship, like you did on radio show. I think we had you on every month or so on the show, and we'd save up the questions and then unload them on you. If you inclined to want to do that, we'd love to have you on the program for sure.
No, I appreciate it. It's an honor to be on the program and have your audience listen to my voice for a little bit. So yeah, it's all good. Thank you. Yeah,
excellent.
All right, man. We'll talk to you in the future. You take care.
Sounds good. Have a great day.
Take care. Wow. A lot of
learned
good
a
stuff.
Lot, didn't we? There,
a lot of good
that
stuff.
That was good.
A lot more than I bargained for. he used to be great when we had him on the radio program. It was
he's very knowledgeable. There's no doubt about it. He's always has been, and I'm sure he always will be. Right? Yeah. He seems to stay up on everything, and
isn't it funny? Because what's old is becoming new. Steve was with us on the old radio show. I told you I spoke to our good friend Sean Kelly recently, who's looking to come back. Gord Pizer is soon going to be here.
Doing podcasts.
So what's old is new, my friend.
Look at you, buddy. Look at you.
What a great show.
Yeah, that was good.
hopefully we can do more of this type of thing.
You know what? I think, I mean, our audience, there's no doubt that a lot of our audience has boats or uses boats or rents boats or whatever, somehow is involved with boats. And this was great. This was great for us, I'm sure.
Oh, no kidding.
It was great for me.
The fact that I know now that I can take my boat someplace and get those 200 RPM that I so badly want.
You know, the thing is, here, everybody listening, Ants is going to pay about $2,000 to get 200 revs. RPM.
200 RPM. Absolutely. That would be cheap.
Oh, God. That's awesome.
Anyways, I want to thank everybody for joining us. Don't forget fishingcanada.com, the portal, the gateway to your next fishing adventure. More importantly, get in there and get some of the goodies that are up for grabs on the contest.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well as the wonderful
shop.fishingcanada.com chance.
Pretty nice.
Okay. I'm still wearing this one that I haven't washed and keep it looking good for the last 3 weeks.
On behalf of the entire crew, Volva, Dean, Nick, when he's here occasionally.
Missing Nick.
He's Peter Bowman. I'm Andrew Boyle. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next time.